So 6 years ago, next Sunday, marks the first time that I stood up here on this chancel. Some of you will remember that I brought my partner and my kids up from Denver, where we were living at the time, to meet the congregation. I didn't start till the summer, but on Mother's Day in 2012, I came up just to kind of say hi. Gracie, my daughter, she was just 6. Joseph had just turned 4. They were so little, but even they still remember that day. I know we have some PKs, that's preacher's kids, out there, so you'll understand their particular sort of memory of that meeting, probably better than others of us, but I'd imagine that either way, it's actually not that different than what many of us felt the first time that we came here to this congregation. Kind of a mixture of fear, confusion, hope. Also, hopefully, welcome. I met so many people that Sunday. It was, for me, also quite overwhelming, but in the best way. Someone helpfully right away gave me a church directory. I think there was a version that had just come out. So I was able to start immediately making notes next to each of the photos about all of the things that people immediately started telling me about themselves. I was afraid that I would, you know, I had a few months before I even was going to start, and there were so many of you. I was afraid I would forget who had told me what, and one of the things that makes church church is that you tell people things, and then they remember who you are. I met at least one of the two who would become known to me as the Aarons that Sunday. In the first church that I served, we had the Sues. There were Sues to meet here too, but they had not yet apparently formed as a group. The Aarons, however, they were a thing. They constituted the two women who I was told were doing amazing work on our new stewardship team, a team they had founded, transforming just the people who'd run the pledge drive to becoming this thing called the stewardship team. They had a plan. See, apparently before the Aarons, we did not talk much about money, and they wanted to change that. They were trying to teach people about abundance and generosity and mission. They were bringing a lot of youthful energy, I was told. They are, by the way, about my age. And I suppose we were younger then. The Aaron I met for sure that day, that's who I was just looking at, was Aaron Price. I remember distinctly, because I will never forget the way that her eyes lit up when I said to her that I love stewardship and spreadsheets. And then I couldn't wait to work with her. She was like, really? It was a little over a year later when the Aarons, the other one being our now board president, Aaron Hottenstein, they decided to make a video of testimonials. They invited some of our high school youth and some of our elders and the ministers and then other leaders that were around at the time in the church. They asked us to share just on one simple question. Why do you love Foothills Unitarian Church? Everyone gave a lot of different answers. I was just re-watching it, actually. It was a fun exercise. You can find it on YouTube. But the one that I didn't need to go back and re-listen to, actually, because I've played it over and over again in my mind since then, was a story that then-Minister Mark Salkin shared in the video about the minister before him, Roy Jones. He said that Roy used to tell him that what he loved about Foothills and what made Foothills Foothills, what made this church, was the people. Foothills has the best people. I've thought about this so much since then because I keep wondering if I agree. I mean, not about whether or not Foothills has the best people, I mean, obviously. But more how this could even be a thing that they would say. I mean, from 1972, when Roy started, to like just a couple years ago and now, and I mean, probably even before Roy, if we talk to Francie Lane or Bob Bacon or Pat Walsh, they were all members in the 60s and are members now. I bet they'd say the same thing about back then. Foothills had the best people, has the best people. It wasn't called Foothills in the 60s, actually, but that's another story. But I keep thinking about this because really it is not possible. Because another thing that makes church church is that there is no constant thing called the people. What makes church church is that the people who are the people become instead different people. Slowly or sometimes suddenly. But certainly constantly. The people are not the people. Because mostly what makes church church is that here in church we mark together the passing of time. We mark time by our presence, our 6- and 4-year-old presence that become 12- and 10-year-old presence, which before we know it will be the presence of graduating high schoolers, God willing. And we mark time too by our absence. Some of the people in the video, it was just about 4 years ago, about already, not all of them are now the people of this church. Some moved away. Some had a life change. Some might return someday. We try to pay attention to absence because it usually means something, small or big. A new job begun, a new relationship, a new sports team, or maybe a feeling of disconnection or struggle, maybe just weariness, less shifting, more accumulation. We try to pay attention to absence. We try to reach out when we notice, but just as often we miss these moments. Sometimes when I light that single candle, I say to myself a little prayer in the silence for all the people who were present and are now absent. But also one of the amazing things that makes church church is that even in absence, people remain somehow also present. Churches are, after all, houses of memory. Sometimes, literally, we hold memorials where we knit together the story of a life lived only as it could be, or more intimately, we gather around bedsides or waiting rooms, and we retell whole life stories, pulling all the pieces together, or trying to. We also often literally display the names of those who have once been here but are now gone, as in the wall right behind this wall. You can go out around the back. You'll find our remembrance garden. You can read there the plaques, the names on the plaques, and imagine as you do, many of them are probably strangers to most of you. No longer here, but once just as much here as you are today. Even without those tangible artifacts, absence does not really mean absence in a church, not really, because churches have a way of collecting us, integrating us, to be forever a part of the church's story. That history that Sean described, one of my mentors says that every church has its own DNA. DNA that's been like constructed by bits and pieces of every person that's ever called this people their people. We, the people of Foothills today, are already a part of this church's DNA. We are shaping it, but also we are It is shaping us, whether we know it or not. John tells the story of a church that he worked with once that was in such serious conflict with its minister that they decided the best way they had to handle it was to change the locks on the church. That got really bad. But what's especially fascinating about this story is that when he went back to look at the history of the church, he found that 250 years earlier, it was a church in New England, 250 years earlier, this church had had a conflict with its minister, and the way they handled it is they changed the locks on the church. My mentor also used to say, it's why you need to be careful what church you join, what patterns you're inhabiting. Just like our individual DNA, this congregation's DNA is a gift and also sometimes a challenge that we're given, and then we decide how to respond. The more we can know about our own story in the largest and also the most the smallest sense, the better we can learn the patterns that we may unknowingly be repeating. And also the more we can choose to learn and grow and change. It is not always clear, I admit, the moment when someone becomes a part of the people of a church. We say it at the beginning of all of our services that our hope is that in this community you will find a people. And one of the things that makes a church church is its mandate to keep opening the circle wide to all who may come to be a part of the people. But it is not automatic or casual. The people of the church are not simply the people who happen to be in the church. Not even the people who are in the church for the second, the third, or even the 30th time are necessarily the people of the church, although by the 30th, you can assume we're wondering. A few weeks ago, Lenny Scovel shared his story, like Sarah did today, of the moment that he said yes to this church. He had been for a long time before that, coming around quite a bit to all sorts of things. But this was the moment where he moved from simply showing up casually to deciding he was going to promise to keep showing up. Promise to show up even when these people did not seem to him like the best people. Even when the people broke his heart. I think if you ask those same folks who've been members since the 60s how many times the best people disappointed them, I'm guessing the stories are many. Because church is not church because it is filled with perfect people, but rather with people who will faithfully peer into the sometimes dense fog of human community and imagine that there is still a blessing there to be born. And church is church most of all because it is filled with the people who will themselves be the blessing. The church is made not simply by the best people, but to paraphrase Unitarian Universalist minister Alice Blair Wesley, it is made by the promising people. In her lecture series, Alice Blair Wesley tells the story of the earliest seeds of all of this sort of church. The earliest gatherings of those pilgrims who fled England, not because they were radical in belief, but rather radical in exactly this question of what makes church church. As Wesley says, they believed that authentic churches are constituted by their members' entry into a covenant, a promise, to faithfully walk together in a spirit of mutual love. Our religious ancestors said any members of any local church gathered in heartfelt union with the Holy Spirit of love can discern together where the Spirit leads. Their radical doctrine relocated religious authority to the lived-in spirit among covenanted members. They said that there could be a church could be a thing without that promise being made explicit, because it could still exist in your heart. But it's better if you kind of write it down and make it official, so that way there's no confusion about who has made a promise and who has not. The reverse, however, they said it was more problematic, because simply making promises does not actually make a church. What makes a church is always the promise that's made real through practice. What makes a church is the promising and also the practicing people. Those early Congregationalists, they settled on two core practices that they said made church church: worship and mutual edification. Now, in case edification is not a word that you use in your everyday life, let me remind you, it means mostly, it means like helping each other be better people, like morally, spiritually. But I also like to think of the word edify as in to strengthen or uplift. Not so different from today, really. On the other hand, as you might have guessed, in those early days of the free church, they did not simply mean to say that a church could be a church by people making promises to each other, or simply practicing those things with their fellow humans. Rather, church was church because those promises were also intended to be to and with God. Or as Alice Blair Wesley repeatedly translates for us today, the Holy Spirit of mutual love. You might remember that two Sundays ago I talked about James Luther Adams, how he believed that liberals needed to embrace the idea of conversion, so that we could manifest the kind of deep commitment needed to face the evils of the day. Conversion, however, was only one part of his solution to make liberals more effective. The other part was about the church itself. In his estimation, too many churches were more about passive intellectual stimulation than compelling transformation. Or, he said, they were too inwardly focused, so that they could never managed to propel themselves and their people to act for more than just their own people. These may be wonderful as social communities, he said, but they're not church. For church to be church, the covenant has to include more than just the people themselves. It has to involve what he called something we cannot control but upon which we depend for our lives. A creative, sustaining, commanding, transforming power that you can interpret theistically or non-theistically. He called it the power of transcendent love. I'm still partial to courageous love. For church to be church, he said, this power must be somehow operative in the promising people, in their covenant, in their practices. It must be alive, coursing through everything that they do together, everywhere that they gather, orienting them to their call and reminding them again and again what really matters, opening their hearts so that they might be compelled to tend to the vulnerable, including themselves, and granting them the courage and the humility to do all they can to love the hell out of this world and each other. Because a church is not just a house of memory, but also of hope. Over the past 6 years, I have felt this power operative in our community, in this promising, practicing people many times. In big public ways, and in small, little ways. It's not just in peak moments, but in the everyday flow, just being together. But also, to be honest, in these last 6 years, there have been times when it has been harder to feel this power at work, when like some of the people who were present were suddenly and then painfully not. And then I find in those moments absence and disorientation. In those moments, I have thought often of Nadia Boltz-Weber, who is a Lutheran pastor I went to seminary with and who is like a rock star now, at least in the church world. One of the things that Nadia talks about in her writings is the Apostles' Creed. Bear with me. How it works in her church, which is very progressive. She admits that there's many days where she is not sure about the Apostles' Creed, all the pieces of it, born of the Virgin Mary, for example, what? And she knows that's true of many in her congregation. There's pieces of the creed, the lines there, that just don't work for all of them. But she says that's why they say it together. Because if any one of them needed to carry the whole thing, they could just say it on their own. But they say it together so they can cover for each other. She figures as a body, at any given time, they got the whole thing covered. So on the days that I'm not feeling the presence of courageous love, when I'm blocked or irritable or just not my best self, I try to remember that someone else, other parts of the promising, practicing people, this promising, practicing people, present, past, future, together we have it covered. Because mostly I know that Roy was right. What makes a church a church, what makes this church is the people. And we have the best people.